from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The Oroville Dam spillway reopened yesterday after 2 years and $1.1 billion spent on repairs, debris cleanup, and emergency response efforts. And that's only one of many water emergencies that California has faced in recent years, including navigating one of the worst droughts in its history. Until February, Felicia Marcus was the chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, and she joins us this segment to discuss California's water challenges and how the state is handling them. And welcome, Felicia Marcus.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
Well, delighted to have you here. And I ought to add, I was being a little corny, which is sometimes my wont, and said there are a flood of issues to talk about here. Forgive my language, but there are indeed. And I was looking at a quote from you where you said, there's no silver bullet to our water problems, no silver bullet to our water problems, only silver buckshot, which makes perfect sense to me. And I want to really tackle some of the biggest challenges that California faces with you, if we can accomplish that. And I hope we can in this hour. And let's begin with water accessibility, because there are 1 million Californians who can't drink water out of their taps.
Yeah, it's astounding and horrifying. I'm glad that Governor Newsom has made that his top priority, because it should be.
And a top priority that can be solved?
Oh, absolutely. It's within our reach. I mean, the legislature and Governor Brown made it a high priority, moved the drinking water program over to us in 2014. It's been a very smooth transition. And then each year, we working with a coalition of disadvantaged community advocates and others, we've been able to get a whole series of tools that have allowed us, and I guess I can use us for another few months, but allowed the State Water Board to be able to start getting water to more people and helping them do it. But we're still missing one final piece, which is a funding source to subsidize operation and maintenance, because you can't build systems for people. You can't do things without them being able to run their systems. And that's been the elusive piece of the puzzle, which if we had it, we now have the authority to consolidate systems, to hire administrators, to do all kinds of things. But without that affirmative subsidy of operation and maintenance dollars, we can't hire the administrators or get things done. But with a relatively small amount of money, you get really high leverage, and we can start to help thousands of more people every year.
Still a big piece, though. And since we're talking about systems,
the missing link.
Yeah, the missing link. Freshwater ecosystems on the brink of collapse?
Well, yeah, quite a few, particularly in the Bay Delta. I mean, it's an interesting thing. And I mean, California is just so fascinating and complex on a whole host of fronts. But we have this incredible ecosystem in the Bay Delta estuary, where the San Joaquin River flows in from the south and the Sacramento from the north. And we have simply just diverted so much water from it to do all kinds of good things, agriculture, urban development, the miracle that is Southern California, as well as the agriculture in the Central Valley, is a miracle of modern history and development. But we've taken so much water out of the system that the ecosystem simply can't function as an ecosystem anymore. And that's probably the struggle of our time. I've worked on it off and on for decades. And it's very hard for people to figure out how to coexist and share water, share our rivers between the ecosystem, agricultural and urban users from a political standpoint. But from a managerial standpoint, we could do it. People just have to agree to do it.
Now, as long as we're talking about managerial questions, there's a lot of concern over really the safety of groundwater, and I want to talk with you about that as well. In the San Joaquin Valley, they want to essentially balance the groundwater accounts, and we're talking about, well, roughly 2 million acres of feet per year. I mean, this would be, somebody once said, like one Don Pedro reservoir of water a year. So we're talking about a huge and enormous challenge.
It is an enormous challenge. The challenge we've had is that groundwater has been overdrafted by about 2 million acre feet a year for many, many years. And again, it's produced a good thing. It's not good or bad. It's produced a good thing, which is food and fiber for us and the nation and the rest of the world. But it's overtaking the ability of the system to replenish itself. And so in 2014, we also had historic sustainable groundwater management legislation passed, which gives local areas, which I think is really good about it, local areas, you know, a reasonable but not an impossibly long period of time to come up with plans for how to live more within their means. And that can take many forms. Part of it is getting more water into the ground when it is plentiful in those plentiful years and in those wet seasons of the year. And part of it will require some cutbacks, which farmers can figure out how to share amongst each other. Some areas are coming up with trading regimes, others with fees and the like. But it certainly won't be without pain. But without action, we were headed for a cliff and a disaster where areas would have been unable to farm for the rest of time.
So, how safe is that groundwater, do you believe, at this point? I mean, particularly with fracking and concerns along those lines.
Well, it really depends on where you are. I think fracking and anything, even just legitimate agricultural practices, can contaminate groundwater. A much bigger deal is the legacy of nitrate pollution. That's what afflicts most of these areas, just from, again, the totally socially productive and totally legal use of nitrogen-based fertilizers on farming. And farmers are working through our regulatory processes now to cut back on the amount of nitrogen that's used. And farmers have come together with disadvantaged communities to figure out how to get drinking water for poor people, because we only drink a fraction of the water that's out there. It's not a contaminant for farming. So how safe it is depends on where you are. We also have naturally occurring arsenic and chromium, which is a piece of why we do need funding from other than farmers to help poor communities get safe drinking water. But we can figure out how to get safe drinking water to folks, and treatment isn't rocket science. It's the application of some money and some know-how and a little bit of energy. We can figure out how to buy some time to pump and fertilize and clean up the groundwater basins over time. So again, it's all very localized, as everything in California is very localized. Every area has a different mix of water sources, different mix of water rights, different geology, et cetera. And so essentially at the state level, the key is to set out some guidelines and put out some tools. And as you know, occasionally we're able to put out some significant levels of funding that people can take advantage of.
Our guest is Felicia Marcus, former chair of the State Water Resources Control Board. And I have to ask you, because I've always been impressed, really, with your knowledge of water in this huge state and so many nuances to it and so many sides to it and dimensions. And yet, why aren't you on the board?
I don't know. I think time is up. You know, it's one of those things where appointments, having been a political appointee at the federal level and the local level as well, you go into administration for a term and a new administration comes in, and it's not an entitlement. They have the right to bring in new people, and they've appointed great people who I'm very happy about at the state board, both to my chair and to my seat. So
Joaquin Esquivel and Laurel Firestone.
Yeah, they're both fantastic. So I was very happy about that. So
let me read a comment, though, actually. A listener says, thank you for your service on the State Water Board. Do you think your replacement by Governor Newsom indicates a likely lessening of water flows in rivers?
Oh, I hope not. I don't think so. I just think it's in any administration, there's a need to freshen it up and have a fresh look. I mean, I had a good turn with my hand on the baton, and I'm happy to pass it off to those guys. I certainly hope not. I don't think that's the governor's intent.
It's been interesting reading some of the comments about your moving on, though. I mean,
oh, really?
a lot of praise for you, deservedly. And yet, I was looking at a Merced paper where someone was saying, you know, you were too gung-ho an environmentalist, criticizing you as being an extension of your work as an attorney for the NRDC, these kinds of things. I mean, it's always a mix. Whenever you're a public servant, you know, this is what you get. Also, I'd like to involve our listeners in this. We're talking about lots having to do with water, and there's lots to talk about, obviously. I haven't even, at this point, gotten to the whole question of President Trump's rolling back clean water rules, but you may indeed want to join us, and if so, I'd like to invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to ask questions of Felicia Marcus or bring your own concerns to the front here in terms of water in California. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And here's a tweet from Olivia. It says, how much of the problem is aggravated by activity by companies like Nestle's? I think she's talking about watersheds for drinking water specifically.
Well, I think, you know, California is a big state, and I think it's easy to point to villains, but generally, whether fracking or Nestle's or whatever, but they actually tend to be a very small part of the water picture in California. So I hesitate to find villains anywhere. I think the biggest issue is simply that it's a big state, so it's hard to communicate across the whole state in a coherent way, and people lead busy lives, so people don't go to water 101 school and have time to understand where their water comes from. Over half the state is hundreds of miles from where their water comes from, and that's, again, a miracle of modern civilization that so many people cannot even know where their water comes from or worry about whether it'll be safe when it comes out the tap. And so it's a myriad of different pieces of the puzzle that that speak to whether we either have water availability, particularly in small disadvantaged communities, who do absolutely know whether their water is coming out the tap and they don't think it's safe. And so they spend twice as much on their water by paying for water service they can't drink and buying bottled water at the moment, or people not realizing that their lavish use of water is leading to the destruction of iconic species like salmon and entire industries like the commercial fishing industry. But that's why I think it's the job of folks in government to stand up and speak for all Californians. And Californians care about agriculture, they care about urban communities, and they care about fish and wildlife. And so the trick in these jobs is to channel what a regular person would want you to do if they knew what you know, which is, you know, what I call the Panetta rule, because it's how Leon Panetta said he made decisions.
All you got to do is mention a word like Nestle, and callers come aboard here. I think Cole wants to address something about Nestle. Cole, go ahead.
Yeah, that was what I was going to call about. You always read about how the Nestle Corporation has been getting these contracts with almost no interference to essentially take a resource that belongs to the people and then sell it back to us. It just seems criminal. I was curious to see what your guests had to say about that.
Felicia Marcus.
No, sure. It's interesting. The water rights system in California, it's interesting when you're the administrator of the system as it is. The whole water rights system is geared around folks having legitimate rights to water. It's a classic Western first in time, first in right, which is why most of our water is spoken for from agricultural interests, primarily in terms of water rights, because they were here first and they grow our food and the like. And if you have a water right, you pretty much have a right to do with it what you will. You can use it to grow food and sell that food, use it to make a product and sell that product. And the only limit, there are two limitations on under California water rights law, which is actually not the most built out water rights law in the West, or it's probably the least built out and clear, but it does have two features that are pretty fantastic. One is the public trust doctrine, which is what helps us care about fish and wildlife on behalf of all Californians, and it has a provision in the Constitution against waste and unreasonable use, which we can use in very specified settings, but we can't pick and choose winners and losers to say we like a particular product or not. It has to be more in this particular time societally is something unreasonable. And if it is, like it can be flood irrigation in the desert or something like that, or I think it was used during the 77 drought to say you can't run a fountain that doesn't use recycled water in the middle of a drought. And we would have marched down that path if it weren't for the fact that the governor gave us the executive order directing us to do mandatory urban conservation regs. So we don't have that many tools.
So Cole used a pretty strong word here. Criminal, he said. This is criminal.
Well, it's perfectly legal in the way the system works.
And there are things that can be characterized that way that are legal within the way the system works. Let me thank Cole for the call. I'll get to another caller right away here. Barbara, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. I live in the west side of the city, and they've changed our water source from the beautiful Hetch Hetchy water to a reservoir, maybe the Sunset Reservoirs. Why did they do it, and is it possible that because they made a change, they're releasing more lead into our water supply? I get this notion that protections have to be set up when you change a water source, and it's from the book What the Eyes Don't See by Mona Hanna Atisha about the Flint water crisis. So how do I know that they haven't, by changing it?
How does she know her water's safe?
Well, that's it.
Yeah. That's the question everybody needs to know. I think two things. I don't know the exact reason for that particular change, but I know there will be, certainly if our Bay Delta standards hold up, the ones the state board did, the city will have to diversify its water supplies in some ways. But there are all kinds of safeguards, particularly with the large municipal water entities. It's pretty heavily regulated. Like, these small disadvantaged communities are too small to even be regulated in many cases by the state board, although we were able to get more authority to help them. There are very strict rules in California about changing water sources and having to check for corrosion control. When Flint happened, I was absolutely aghast because it violates California. It violates water, drinking water 101, in terms of the integration of what your source water is with what your pipes are. To me, that was the most astounding lack of judgment, oversight, and effort I could imagine. And but in California, you can't change your water source without going through a regulatory. You have to go to the district engineer and public health focus.
You're saying something like that could not happen here?
I think it's highly unlikely to happen here just because the practices are so much stronger. Here, the major sources of lead that people are getting in their water as opposed to the other lead exposures are from the brass fixtures, the brass in the fixtures that they have in their houses or old lateral pipes. That's why we now have the ability to test schools and the like. There are a lot of older schools that have problems with their lines. So there's a problem that can be between the water purveyor's line and your house. So I think checking people checking their fixtures to make sure they're newer and don't have old brass or lead fittings is really pretty important. I mean, that's the challenge with lead, is that you can get it from so many places.
Many sources, yeah. Here's let me thank you for the call, Barbara. And here's Ben, who asks, how concerned should we be with groundwater pollution and potential pollution from landfills, which have earth caps and might be disturbed by earthquakes? Is this something that keeps you up at night?
Oh, gosh, there's so many things that used to keep me up at night. I'm just learning how to sleep through them. But I sort of wake up worried. I think our water supply is actually pretty astoundingly good. I mean, again, it's a miracle of modern civilization that so many can turn their taps without fear, particularly if you're in an urban area. If you're getting groundwater from your own domestic well, I think it's important to get it tested. Sometimes people, the State Water Board would offer testing for free, and there's a whole map up on the Gamma site. I can't remember now what it stands for, and thinking about it will take too much time, on the water board site, where we have instances of toxicity we know about. And there are times where people won't even let us test their wells for free. So I think the places to be most worried are in small systems and in domestic wells. When it comes to landfills, I used to run a public works department. It's two things. The regulations are now very strict with double liners and the like. It's the liner underneath that's perhaps more important than the cap, although the cap is important as well. But it really also depends on how well it was designed and constructed and how well the monitoring underneath it works. And so in that case, it's important to go to the local law. I think it's the LEA. Again, I'm not sure what that acronym stands for, or the local environmental health department, which usually is within the county, or even just the drinking water division of the State Water Board would be able to point you in the right direction. But I think in most cases, it's really rather safe. Those aren't the issues that keep me up at night as much as the fact that we might drive fish to extinction and the fact that we do have all these people in disadvantaged communities who can't trust the water that comes out their tap and are paying for bottled water at the same time they're paying for water they can't drink.
You mentioned a couple other things that perhaps keep you up at night. I was thinking about the Colorado River, which
is
chronically
yes.
overused, serving about 400 million people. And we're talking about really aquifers that are declining, and we're talking about the effect of climate change. I mean, we could go on, but I alluded to earlier, though, something, time permitting, maybe we can talk about the Colorado River, but I alluded to something earlier I wanted to get to with you, and that's the Fight Over Clean Water Act. I mean, the state really wants to protect and expand watersheds, and the EPA is saying, you know, there's too much oversight. I mean, that's essentially their position, and the regulations can affect millions of acres. I mean, there's a lot at stake here.
Well, there is. It's interesting how I was thinking as I came over here a lot that sound bites are the stuff of politics, but sound bites aren't solutions. And the fact of the matter is that there can be an anti-regulatory bias that comes from a political or an ideological sense that doesn't necessarily make sense, even for the regulated entities. Having worked in regulation and having been regulated when I ran the LA Public Works Department for 4 years, so I know what it feels like to be regulated by state and federal government. And sometimes it seems nutty and it doesn't make sense. Other times it's incredibly important. And what I found is that businesses that want to, and developers that want to do a good job and care about things as much as anyone, they want good, thoughtful regulations to create a level playing field where the scofflaws or the laggards don't get an economic advantage by not having to comply with good laws and regs. And so I think particularly yesterday's state board vote was very important in updating the wetlands rules. It's been cast as a response to the Trump administration rollback. Been working on it for 10 years because it's hard to do, because the state actually has this fairly broad authority to regulate wetlands, they use the dredge and fill rule, as they see it in a case-by-case basis, which wasn't good either for the environmental community that was concerned that you might have regional water boards that weren't as sensitive, and it was you couldn't predict what was going to be protected. And you also had folks in the development world and the agricultural world who didn't know where they couldn't plan ahead for where they could go and had to go through a very long case-by-case determination. So good public policy is trying to define and set the rules of the road so that people can predict what's more likely to happen, so that developers don't waste a lot of money trying to develop where they really shouldn't, and environmentalists don't stay up all night chewing their nails because they're worried about protecting one of the last, 9% of the remaining wetlands in California.
There's a definite balance you're talking about.
Yeah, but clarity and certainty and fairness is what good laws and good regs should have. And when you do that, people are rarely happy. But I found that folks respect the fact that you tried to listen to all of their views and come up with something intelligible, which, you know, is no mean feat.
We'll bring in more of our callers. We're talking to Felicia Marcus, and she's a former chair of the State Water Resources Control Board. And our next caller is Dick. Join us. You're on the air.
Good morning. A couple of issues. I'll try and keep it brief. I called in recently when we were talking about water and mentioned that we have about 450% water allocations for how much water we get every year, and it was kind of poo-pooed. But when we get a 10-year drought, there's going to be so many lawsuits about who gets what rights based on how far back you went, et cetera. And when we don't have enough water, it's going to get ugly. Number two is the situation that California farmers, I grew up in Modesto. I worked in Westlands Water District for 15 years for a family farm. I've been a commercial salmon fisherman. And I find the fact that California farmers have about 87% of the water rights in California and produce less than 10% of the gross daily product in California is a situation that the state's going to have to step into and intervene at some point. We need to buy out those lands that are full of selenium. We need to pay off these farmers who don't want to be farming that land and owning that land. And also the fact that when DIFI created, it gave the Kern County Water Bank to Dusty Resnick in exchange for grade B and C water rights, as Cole called in earlier. That was criminal behavior in my book. But I just think we need a bigger solution to California's water problem. We need a bigger picture of who really needs this water and who's going to get it in the future.
Yeah, I like what you're saying here, Dick. There's a lot to unpack in what you've said so far, but let's go to Felicia Marcus.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think thinking about the water rights system is a totally valid thing. I think if our drought had gone 10 years, you would have seen a much more serious look at that. You'd also would have had urban areas buying a lot of water from agricultural areas over time. And
sorry, but you know what keeps echoing in my head? How much have we really learned from this drought?
I think we've learned a lot. I mean, part of what we doubled down on in legislative ask was information during this drought. I referenced the fact that California's water rights system is less built out than others. We haven't adjudicated. Colorado's been 30 years. They even calculate how much runs off people's roofs so that they have it down to we don't. We were doing it by abacus during the drought. And so what we ended up doing was getting emergency power to do emergency information orders, particularly around the Delta. We got legislation that allowed us to finally, believe it or not, we finally had measurement regulations for all diverters from California waters as of 2016. I mean, It's amazing that in this day and age, California hasn't built out that system. But we double down on information because that lays a foundation to have an intelligent conversation about our water rights. It's an interesting thing on the issue of over-allocation. I think his percentages are correct, absolutely, if you look at the face value of all of our water rights. But the thing about water rights is it's a, you know, the whole West uses this system. It's a way to allocate shortages, and its decision is first in time, first in right, like by the nanosecond, which is really hard to judge. And, you know, sometimes it rains, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes there's no such thing as an average year, right? It's a statistical construct. So you do have five times the average, but sometimes you have plenty for everybody and sometimes you don't have enough. And that's when you need to curtail the more junior users. The thing over the years is we haven't exercised those authorities the way we should have. So people thought it would never happen, and they've confused their water rights with an absolute right to all the water that their grandparents told them they had, when in fact your water right is very much subject to curtailment, but we didn't have the best information available. Now we'll have better information available and we're more prepared, but there's a lot more work to do before the real 10-year drought. That was the Godzilla of wake-up calls for us.
The mother of all droughts. I want to get to another caller. I want to first read a tweet from Nicole, who writes, I wish they would make Water 101 a class in middle school. In Germany, we pay a lot of money. My parents hammered frugal use into my head. Here's a caller from Oakland. Evan, join us. You're on.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Chair Marcus, I just wanted to thank you. I heard the earlier negative comments, but I wanted to thank you for your leadership at the State Board for bringing trash as a matter of pollution into our stormwater system and highlighting that as an issue that we need to regulate, and for leading the process to regulate trash and stormwater systems throughout the state. I think it's worth letting the listeners know that we now regulate the amount of trash that will be emitted from our stormwater systems across the state, and we'll have the strictest regulations across the country in a very short time. So thank you for leading that process, and to your staff for following through on some really incredible work.
All right,
thank you. Speaking about things regular people do care about.
Yeah, indeed. And I think, as I said, hats off to you. I'd like to also add my voice to that for the job you've done and how much you've served the state. I wish you the best of luck wherever you're headed. Where are you headed?
I don't know yet. I'm taking some time to get some sleep and listen to people's ideas, travel a little bit, play with my grandson, and then I'll figure it out in the next few months.
You just shocked me because you don't at all look like a grandmother, but we'll leave it at that.
Thank you
so much for joining us. Felicia Marcus, again, former chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, and we thank you. And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And two more segments of Forum are up ahead. Stay tuned for them, and thank you for being a part of this hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.